Okay, well, let's get started. Thank you all. Thank everyone for being here. It's great to see a pretty engaged and pretty large audience. I'm Nithin Koka. I'm a freelance journalist, and I am the moderator of this panel, focusing on how to include environmental justice in climate stories. So just a little background. This panel came together collaboratively. It's not an official Uproot project panel, but we're all members of the Uproot project, and we developed this idea within the community. The Uproot project, for those of you who don't know, it was launched in 2021 officially, and it's a network to support the work of environmental journalists of color and helping advance the careers of reporters of color who have been historically underrepresented in environmental journalism. I think the recent Pew study said something like 84% of journalists at newsrooms in the U.S. covering environment were not journalists of color. So we're trying to work to improve that figure. And we're also trying to bring more diversity and more diverse stories and diverse topics to conferences like SCJ. I say that because this was not my panel idea. It came together like several people are not even here. And we wanted to just bring in different discussions and topics to SCJ. And the focus of this is, I'll just say, like, we're not, if you're here, I think you should already believe that EJ is important. We're not here to convince you that EJ is important. What we're here to try to do is, like, talk about how we can do environmental justice reporting better and how we can make sure that nearly all climate journalism has a strong and well-done climate justice and environmental justice angle, which is something I'm dealing with as a challenge. I cover environmental issues in Asia, and I'm dealing with different communities all the time, and I'm always trying to learn how I can do a better job of, you know, including their stories in a way that is uplifting and empowering and also helps further the discussion on climate and climate justice. So we'll start with them. I want to ask all the panelists to introduce themselves, and also we'll go through each of the questions. So Aaliyah, do you like to start?
Yes. Can you hear me well? My name is Aaliyah Utiuova. I'm a reporter for The Guardian US. I cover environmental justice, and I cover it visually, so I make graphics. I work on data analysis. I sift through spreadsheets to tell the story in a narrative manner.
Hi, everybody. My name is Iris Crawford, and I'm the climate justice senior editor at the Nonprofit Quarterly. I get to work with a lot of climate justice advocates and activists and leaders in the field and help amplify their stories. I also have a background in grassroots organizing, which I think has helped me do a lot of the relationship building needed to do this kind of beat. So thanks, everybody, for coming, and I hope you enjoy.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brittany Cordera. Currently, I'm the newsroom intern at St. Louis Public Radio, and I will be the environment and science reporter for State Impact Oklahoma very soon. I cover this beat, particularly when it comes to black farmers and urban farming and Justice 40 initiative monies, and kind of tracking those monies and seeing where they're going to and if they're actually going towards equitable things. So I very much value uplifting the voices of the black community and also the LGBTQ community and the indigenous community and other POC communities. And I think in order to do that, the EJ angle has to very much be present. So thank you for being here.
Thank you. So now we're going to all move over to the questions. And we'll, so, shift.
Ready? We're shifting gears.
Yeah. Thank you, everyone, for doing this. We just thought this would be a creative way to get some more input for everyone. Do you guys want to spend, I guess I'll start, like, I want to ask all of you three to answer the question, and then maybe take a look at the answers and give some feedback. We don't have to go in order, so I'll just go with you since you're closest. So the second question was, Is environmental justice a beat or an essential part of any climate story? Can you give your perspective and then also talk about what people answered?
Yeah, so this is a really great question. Thanks for asking it, Nathan. Part of me wants to say it kind of depends. And then part of me as a personal, like just on my own reporting, yes. It depends because like climate change is not just changing our environment, but it's changing people. And if you don't report on people, then maybe there's not an EJ angle to pursue. But climate change for me is human change. And even when our other than human relatives are affected, those effects also trickle down into our own impacts as human beings. Maybe we should close the door. It is kind of loud. Yeah. For me personally, as a reporter, I would say environmental justice is essential in climate stories because climate change is human change. And even when we are looking at other living things, those things are impacting us as much as we are impacting them. That's just my takeaway. And then did you want me to look at some of these things? Okay, so we have a big resounding yes. we have one here. So I think there's like three different answers. No, justice plays a crucial role, essential. Capturing the nuances of the story and communication. So I want to say for this one, capturing the nuances of the story and like communication. I also do a lot of like environmental and culture reporting. And I really feel like when those nuances can really be found in those kinds of stories. And those kinds of stories also lend themselves to justice reporting very well. That's something I wanted to say with that. A climate story can you help me read that?
No climate story is complete without talking about EJ.
Oh, no climate story is complete without talking about EJ. I kind of feel like this is a great point. It can oftentimes feel like there's something missing if you're not including the justice angle. And the justice angle can definitely let you go a bit deeper. I will say, though, like, you know, we are all tied to deadlines. And to do this kind of reporting, you really need to cultivate relationships with your communities. And so, I want to encourage people to find an EJ angle, but I don't want you to do it haphazardly, and I don't want you to do it on a time crunch, because I don't think the best reporting will come from that. Go ahead.
So I have number three. What to you is the key to a well-reported climate story? And I think I've learned in my time reporting and being an editor, it's making sure your sources are happy. Like, for example, one time where my sources, I felt bad personally. I was working on a story with Investigate West, their decarbonizing Cascadia series. And I did a bunch of reporting with some of the indigenous tribes that were there, which was, I'm trying to think, folks in Seattle, Washington, Oregon area. And because it didn't fit the story angle, I couldn't, you know, put that into the story. And I know that we are not supposed to be married to our words, but it just took a lot of time to develop those relationships. And because I couldn't use it in the story, I felt a little devastated. I think what is also key to a well-reported climate story, I would say making sure that you highlight how your sources are people and what is their agency, what is their resilience if you do have to report on their trauma. So just making sure that, you know, they are the center of your story and not this flood happened and here's how it affected these people. So that's what I would say. And I'll go to the some of the answers. So saying what's at stake for people impacted and including history, deeper context of the issue, focusing on resiliency, and communication is just important for the victims. So I really like that one. And I would say reporting on the people, not the data, is another good one. And a nuanced with a local perspective from the community members. So I like all these answers. I think everybody understands the relationship aspect. And now we will go to Aaliyah.
Thank you. My question was, is it possible to do good climate reporting without including EJ? I don't believe that it is. And luckily I'm in a newsroom where majority of our climate stories do tell and center environmental justice stories. So I guess it's really hard nowadays to report on climate without acknowledging, if not putting it, you know, front and center, the environmental justice impact of any new climate initiatives or updates. So to me, it's like when there's like a new concrete, micro concrete or whatever being developed, which seems like a climate science story, you have to think about, well, you know, who's manufacturing it? Where is it going to be laid? Which people are going to live closest to the fumes? Who's doing the dumping of the construction? That's when you start focusing on the people. And to me, that's the most important part. And same with electric vehicles. That is very much an environmental justice story because the nation is pushing towards electrifying, but these charging stations are getting built in communities where people might not want them or might not have the ability to purchase them. And those are just a few examples. And Ethan, maybe you can read the post-it notes.
I think on this question we had the most unity. I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 no's, so I'm glad to hear that. And then I like this comment, so I'm going to read this one out. Such a large aspect of journalism is telling every side of the story, and unfortunately, minority stories are excluded when they're disproportionately affected. So I think there a thorough story has an element of environmental justice to it, at least. So we'll take photos of this later, and I really thank everyone for giving their answers. We also put the questions up on WUVA, so if you want to continue providing your insight, please answer the questions there. But let's go back to the panel. Let's go back to the desk, and you guys can all face forward. And it's good to hear, like, I feel like there's, what I want to get into next is, like, it's easier said than done to do this type of reporting well. And I want to ask our panelists to get into the details of how they did some of their stories. So I actually have specific questions for all of you. I'll start with Iris. You did a piece on these UpRose's Sunset Park solar project. And you showed in that article that there are models and ways to build renewable energy, something we heard a lot about at this conference, in a just way that involves communities. So I was wondering if you can tell us more about how you reported that story and how this frame is something you think could be used for other people looking at solar or wind projects around the country.
Thanks for the question, Nathan. So that story was on a Brooklyn-based organization called UpRose. They're in Sunset Park, Brooklyn. And they started back in the early 2000s fighting a lot of power plants that were going to be set up there. So I came to that story from being connected through the through the Climate Justice Alliance, CJA, and they're a national sort of alliance that connects like all different types of EJ groups across the country. Oh, hold on, guys. I'm thirsty. No. I'm okay. And so what they did was there are a lot of different solar, companies and nonprofits that are operating with this sort of community model. And who they worked with was called Working Power. So they raise funds to help communities such as the Sunset Park community, Uprose, different kinds of organizations, be able to be self-sustaining in how they get their solar systems working. Uprose was also able to partner with Con Edison, which is like the big utility in New York. And one thing that their executive director, Elizabeth Yampierre, if you guys don't know her, definitely look her up, said that a lot of the government officials in New York are starting to really listen to communities of color. But she said that that also has to do with a lot of different kinds of people now entering government. And I think we're seeing, you know, considering like who's are now Secretary of the Interior and all different, the EPA's like new EJ office, I think these sort of government positions are being more representative of the people that they're governing and impacting. So I really was able to come to report on that story just through community relationships and being connected with the Climate Justice Alliance. And I will say, I don't think that being a reporter of color or an LGBTQAI plus reporter or anything that may be, I don't think that necessarily is important to whether or not you're able to build trust. I think it's if you come in with the intention that I want to build a relationship with you, I want to check in with you, see how you're doing. I think that that's what communities are mostly looking for now. It doesn't have to do with what you look like and where you come from. So, I hope I answered your question, Nathan.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah. Aaliyah, I wanted to ask you, the stories you shared, there's particularly one story about inequality and heat-related deaths. You really should use data in a way to show like how climate is impacting a frontline community. And I think it's a common theme in your reporting is the use of data. Can you talk about how you use data to illuminate environmental justice angles?
Yeah, so the story you're talking about is a story I did on the heat inequality and the unequal impact of heat in American cities. I reported on Houston's shade inequity and temperature changes despite changes given your neighborhood, the heat island effect, your proximity to the highways, and how that and the lack of trees and shrubs and shade can make your neighborhood several degrees hotter. I did a story next year on New York City where we found that South Bronx is particularly close to Cross Bronx Expressway, which was built by Robert Moses, which you might be familiar with Pete Buttigieg mentioning the racist construction of these highways in the 60s. So that area of New York City was eight degrees hotter than wealthier neighborhoods in Manhattan, like the Upper West Side, Upper East Side, which is some of the city's richest neighborhoods. And, I went interviewed people like right underneath the Cross Bronx, which was in a community park, like one of the only green spaces that these residents have gotten. And I went to like listen to my recording and I couldn't hear it. I barely could hear it. It was a Saturday, 6 a.m., but there were already trucks, there were cars, and there is a Fresh Direct warehouse right like adjacent to where that park stood. And the person I was speaking with, she's like, well, imagine living here 24/7. The noise pollution alone is enough to make you so stressed. And given that also that South Bronx has the nation's one of the biggest, one of the highest childhood asthma rates in the country, it's really... it's a story we should be doing, I think, in every city. The data I used was from this group called Kappa Health, C-A-P-A. They use citizen science to go and survey the neighborhoods with thermometers in the morning, afternoon, and night. And this initiative is happening in a lot of cities in North Carolina and Baltimore, in cities in Georgia, and I encourage you to look at that temperature data, and if you have questions, please feel free to reach out, because once you map it out, the reality is there, and it's just a matter of telling it.
Excellent. Thank you. Brittany, I really enjoyed reading your piece on regenerative farming, because it's something I've seen so much written about so much as a solution, a climate solution, something that can help sequester soil and help. But your story is one of the first ones I read that talked about how access to regenerative farming is not equal, and there's an equity problem and a financial problem. Can you talk about that story and like why that type of angle is important in that type of, you know, commonly covered topic?
Sorry. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Nathan, for reading that story and for the insightful question. Hopefully, I can answer it without being too nervous. But could you please remind me of the question so I can make sure that?
Yeah. I guess I. Right. For me, you took an equity lens in the article. Talk about how Black and Indigenous farmers don't have access to capital or land to be able to do regenerative farming, and that it's a solution that's not available to these communities,
right.
Which is a perspective I'd never seen. So I want to know how you found that idea, and how did you illuminate this?
So this idea started off by looking at the Farm Bill and looking at the Young Farmers Coalition, how they contributed to the Farm Bill. So I had to like read the Farm Bill, and then I had to then read this coalition's like own studies that they had found out about access to land specifically, and how that access to land is not being utilized to, or like, I'm sorry. So access to land, and then how a lack of access to land for Black and Indigenous farmers is causing problems. So we live in a world where our farms are mostly being used. Our farmlands, vast portions of farmlands are owned by the USDA, being used to cultivate soybeans and corn. And that's not healthy for the land. It's not a good use of the land, and it's not healthy. The farmer that I spoke with, his name is John Kent. He was really cool. I got to actually see his farm in Detroit. It's these like small urban farms that are really making a huge impact in their urban areas because of their proximity to communities that are considered food deserts or at risk of being in a food desert. So this particular farmer on Detroit's east side, he creates compost from the scraps of food from his neighbors. The neighbors are incredibly involved in the farming process. And then he distributes that food, to his community that there's not a grocery store within a mile of this community. So, going back to the regenerative aspect of this story, when we're growing soybeans and corn on these, thousands upon thousands of acres of land, we're not putting nutrients back into the soil to help the soil. We're not, we're abusing the land. We're like, the land is like tired of growing corn and soybeans all the time when especially vast prairies had so much more biodiversity in them. And so, This is small scale. This is urban farm, but this can really be looked at as a way to Black and Indigenous farmers are very much interested in cultivating regenerative practices that stem from Indigenous practices of using the land and stewarding the land. We have Black and Indigenous farmers who want to do this but are being denied land. And if they're being denied land, how can we actually get to the heart of healing or, like, you know, becoming net zero and, like, all of these climate goals that the U.S. wants to do? So it was a great story to, like, really connect with this farmer. And, you know, I really enjoyed talking with him and making that connection. But yeah, like, this is a small scale that can really be taken at a larger scale. And it's all about land back. I hope that answers the question. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll move on to some general questions now, trying to dig into the details of how we do this type of reporting well. So I first want to ask, like, for any of you, was there a story you worked on that didn't have an obvious environmental justice angle, but you're still able to, in a meaningful way, include environmental justice in that story? Any? If no one has an example, I can think of something. I'll give a quick answer, but I did a piece about waste energy in Southeast Asia, which is the practice of burning garbage to avoid landfill, but also generate electricity. And I did a story about how this potential project would impact waste pickers. And I had not seen anyone else look at this angle, but, like, waste pickers, there's hundreds of thousands of them. They're mostly women and children. They're from the most marginalized communities, and they would be displaced and lose their livelihood if this project got built. Even though the project is framed as it's going to, you know, reduce landfill, these communities depend on the landfills. They're the ones who are doing the recycling. And they argue, like, why are we not being involved in the solution? If you actually want to solve the problem of waste, you should talk to the communities dealing with waste every day, not just bring in a technology from far away. So I was able to, I really enjoyed the chance to get to speak with those communities and talk and learn about, like, I didn't actually realize at the time that most of these are women and children working in these landfills. I didn't realize there's hundreds of thousands of them in Indonesia. And I didn't also realize they're organizing and they're fighting and they're not just passive, passively, like, accepting this as a faith. They're trying to, like, improve their lives. And there should be a way to empower them.
I think something that I would like to add to that is just that, I don't know if I've particularly done a story where I discovered an EJ angle as I was reporting it. I kind of came into it being like, I wanted to do the EJ angle, and so I'm going to do that. But there was a story about, you know, in the St. Louis region, a nearby city in St. Louis, there was contaminants found in their water. And I felt like I was, like, one of the first reporters to get, like, a comment from the mayor on that story and to get comments from the community on that story, because a lot of the news that was breaking was just that, oh, they're closing down they're closing down their water fields and importing water from the Mississippi River instead of the groundwater that they're traditionally using. And so I think for that story, like, it wasn't really meant to be EJ, but because I got the opinions of the mayor and some of the locals, it ended up being more of an EJ story than I thought. But yeah, thank you.
There was one recent story I did talking about net energy metering 3 that recently got passed in California. So net energy metering is basically anybody who's hooked up to the grid, whatever excess energy you produce, you'd get paid for it. So recently in California, they passed a new version of it, NEM3, which sort of slashes a lot of the which slashes like 70% of the payments that people would get if they produce this excess energy. So first, it was mostly just going to be a policy story, like explaining what NEM is and then how it sort of evolved into this third iteration. But then I realized, you know, just exactly who would be affected by this policy change. So for the first time in California, lower income and middle income households actually surpassed wealthier households in adopting solar. And so it became an EJ story. I'm like, okay. You know, this is, I don't know if anybody has heard of the book by Shalonda Baker, Revolutionary Power for something, something. But she basically talks about the energy utility and how they use a racially divisive playbook that a lot of the energy utilities sort of use as their false belief that getting rid of sort of their false belief that like everything is equal, but it's not equitable. And so she sort of makes that point in the book. Shalonda Baker, she's also in the Biden-Harris administration and a professor at Northeastern. I would definitely say check out the book. But anyway, policy story became an EJ story. So, yeah.
Thank you. I'm curious. This is a question I'm always concerned about. Like, how do you ensure that the voices you include in your reporting really reflect the diversity of voices in that community? And how, like, for me, it's always wondering if I'm only talking to the men, am I missing like a perspective from women or other genders? Am I missing perspective from young people and older elderly people? How do you make sure you're not just speaking to the same person that always talks loudly, but really understand the community?
Yeah, I can speak to maybe when you're starting reporting, and people are hesitant to speak to you for whatever reason, I think telling them that the only way you can tell this story properly is by with the help of you and by speaking to you. One of the examples I can give recently was I went to Philadelphia to cover the proposed capping of the Vine Street Expressway, which divides Philadelphia's Chinatown. And the expressway in the 90s split the historic Chinatown. It stalled the potential for the Chinatown's growth. And I don't know if you're familiar with Philadelphia, but the city's definition, the Google Maps definition of Chinatown borders depends on who you talk to. And because it's smaller on the official records, but you go there, you speak to people, you find out that actually the first Chinese business was built here, and it's not within the Google Maps definitions of Chinatown. So what I did was, I am a member of AAGA, Asian American Journalists Association, so I reached out to someone in the Philly chapter, and I got to Philly earlier, and we sat down for tea, and she said, here are the people you should talk to, but here are the people who you absolutely should not talk to. And I think getting that was so helpful, because the dynamics in the community that is so deeply rooted in because when you report on the community that looks like you, when they read it, it matters so much more to them. They're going to rip it to shreds. They're going to dissect it. And it's a huge responsibility and an honor. So they are going to pay attention. So it's, I don't want to, you know, be driven by fear of getting it wrong, rather than I want to be driven by the desire to get it right. And I think really using your connections to go there and do as much of learning about the different groups, speaking to the groups, knowing who not to talk to, and really like questioning your own instincts, but also leaning into them when you can.
And I'll probably add, once you've asked enough people, who else should I talk to? Who else should I talk to? I think you've got it covered when you start hearing the same things. I don't know if that has happened to you guys. So, yeah. I also wanted to say very quickly, too, in terms of like source, making sure that your sources are equitable and diverse, and making sure you're not sort of picking upon the same people. There are a lot of new resources that we can really look to. I don't know if folks know like the Open Notebook. They have like lots of resources on different types of scientists and their, you know, whatever they identify as. So I think looking at those sources too, I know this isn't particularly community, but just making sure that you tap into those resources when looking for experts and sources and things like that as well. Also, Carbon Brief also has a great database on sources in the Global South. I wanted to plug that too. It's new.
I wanted to also just add, there's another source for, I'm like looking up the source. There's another source to actually, like, it's specifically for getting sources of color. I think it's just called Sources of Color. For journalists, it's free. And so if you look it up online, you can like join this group, and it'll help you connect with sources, people of color for your sources, specifically. If you're not a journalist, I think there's like a nominal fee that you have to pay, which is kind of weird. I'm like still trying to wrap my head around it, but I think that could be a very valuable tool as well. It's kind of new too.
Thank you. And I'll maybe we'll try to post all these links on the WUVA page on the chat so everyone can see it. I have a related question. Like, have you ever encountered resistance from a community because someone had a negative experience with a previous journalist? Kind of like what you said, like they criticize a story or they see something that's badly covered and they think you're coming to do the same thing. And how do you overcome that, or how do you deal with that kind of resistance in a community?
Maybe I'm still very young in this field, but I haven't actually encountered that issue yet. I've been doing journalism since 2021, like since Uproot Project came out. All of my sources have been very like willing and very eager to share their stories, especially on the environmental justice stories. A common theme that I keep hearing throughout the panels is that we're in a news desert, right? So, and as like covering environmental justice, hopefully you are inherently covering communities that aren't getting the coverage that they need. I haven't really encountered that issue. Maybe that'll come up later. I will say the politicians are just more difficult to navigate. So, when you're like trying to hold people accountable, I still have a lot to learn when it comes to like accountability journalism, but when you're trying to hold people accountable and like really asking, well, okay, who's benefiting from this policy versus who's not? I feel like politicians don't want to answer those questions very well.
Do you have any thoughts on this?
I guess I'll pass because this one I feel like it was like not quite that. So yeah.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Well, one last question I had. So I think one theme that's come up in this conference is we shouldn't be doing extractive journalism in communities. We shouldn't be just going there to take stories out. And beyond that, like, I think justice often implies these communities have gone through trauma, generational trauma or even recent events. How do you make sure your stories maintain accuracy but also uplift your sources and their work and the communities?
I think we have to be realistic in... when we approach this, our job is not to remove the pain. It's impossible. All we can do is hear them, share the story, and reduce, potentially, that's the hope, to reduce the impact of the pain, whether that's through legislative change, whether that's through greater coverage and attention to it. I think one story that comes to mind is myself and my colleague Carrie Gillum worked on this series called The Paraquat Papers, where she's an incredible reporter, veteran reporter who's been covering Monsanto, Syngenta, the makers of that pesticide, the weed killer that people who have been applying or mixing this chemical years down the line have been diagnosed and deteriorating from this neurological disease, Parkinson's. And for the longest time, the Syngenta denied the link that it the paraquat crosses the brain-blood barrier. But one day, a box of discoveries, 5,000 pages of documents have been dropped off in her doorstep. And in it, there is historical Syngenta and Chevron internal memos that date back to their knowledge of the paraquat's link to Parkinson's disease. And it was a process of speaking with people who are suing the companies, people who are describing to you all the losses they're going through, and you really have to be realistic, because even in these lawsuits, people have passed away before even seeing the verdict. So it can be incredibly hard for them to open up to you, but once they do, you really you really move forward with telling their story as best as you can, and we did, and it brought on some regulatory change. People cited our reporting in the letters to the California Pesticide Regulation Department so that pesticide doesn't get, the paraquat doesn't get renewed for another 20 years and hopefully will go off the market. Also, our reporting was cited in scientific journals about Parkinson's disease. So it's really, it's hard to see the difference, but you hope you will. And with that story, I'm very, very proud of the work we did. And I think we're seeing some change, hopefully.
So I guess when it does come to reporting on trauma, as Leah said, you do have to, so I guess I could talk about one story I did for Sojourners magazine, and it was about the Lakota Sioux, who are in South Dakota, and they are becoming independent of the grid. So they have, so they started this organization or nonprofit called Indigenized Energy Initiative. And so the lead up to them becoming energy independent was really deep. Like for example, in the story I talk about sort of their journey from South Dakota to the Montana territory with the Northern Cheyenne, basically fighting the Battle of Little Bighorn. And I think just the story and battle leading up to clean energy is traumatic. So I think I did a lot of reporting. Actually, my first couple of interviews were with Otto Braidedhair, and he is one of the elders there. And my first couple of interviews were just listening to him talk about this battle and talk about the battle with Arch, I think it's Arch Cole, who mined 1.3, well, they were trying to mine 1.3 billion pounds of coal from Otter Creek, which runs through the Northern Cheyenne Territory. And I think I didn't even get to the part where they launched Indigenized Energy for until like 2 weeks, until he just felt comfortable like walking me through the history of how they got to where they are today. So I think just taking that time to listen to your sources, of course, yeah, we are in deadlines, but I just had to sit back and just listen. So yeah. And I think in that reporting, I think talking about it was also healing for him in some way. Talking about it with someone who isn't, you know, from the nation, isn't, you know, a politician or somebody from Arch Coal or trying to convince me that why this history is important. So I just wanted to say that.
I think I just have something very short to add to this. I don't know if I've ever really done a service journalism piece or anything like that, but But I really love doing volunteer work and finding stories doing that work and connecting with sources doing that work. So I volunteer with a few different urban farms in and around St. Louis, and I have connected with Black and Indigenous urban farmers in the area through that. And, you know, I'll go out, you know, for a couple hours one day a week, and just as somebody would be like, what do you have for me this week in terms of a story, I'll just do the same thing. I'm like, what's going on in your community? What's not getting reported? And that just allows me to, like, get out in the community, but also to check in on my sources, to know that to ensure to them that I care and I'm going to be there when I can. And also to just learn new skills and things like that as well. So I feel like I'm kind of killing multiple birds with one stone by actually getting out into the community and volunteering.
Thank you, everyone. It leads to, I guess, another common theme we've had today is that it takes time to build these relationships. So what can, like, how can newsrooms, editors, like, support, like, good quality, well-done environmental justice reporting on climate issues? And any thoughts on that?
We need to hire more environmental justice reporters. We need more people covering it. There's not enough. It's an outstanding beat, and there should be, because I'm a visual journalist, I really want to have more visual journalism on this, and whether that's investing in your data program, investing in the hiring more data journalists, I'm all for it. My colleague Manvi is here from the West Coast, and we've been chatting about the possibility of investing in Spanish-speaking classes, and, well, firstly, hiring dual-lingual journalists. And I think there's lots of stuff, and it depends on the newsroom, but it's really advocacy starts in your newsroom, I think. Whether it's involving your colleagues who don't look like you to give you more funding, more opportunities to have the story be on the front. Sometimes it requires some prior notice, like keeping your colleagues posted on, hey, I'm working on this cool story, or, mind sharing it, mind putting it in the front of the audience. Like, that is, like, some of the newsroom dynamics that I'm learning more about. Do you have anything to add?
I would say, as an editor, the first thing I do whenever I accept a pitch is make sure myself and the writer are clear on what the story is going to be. And usually, what ends up happening is I'll always get on the phone with the writer. I'm like, what are you thinking of reporting? Who are your sources? Do you need help finding sources? Let me know if I can do anything on my part. So I think really just making myself available has been helpful. I think also telling my writers that if you need more time, let me know. I think there's always a workaround with a deadline. I would also say one thing that's been interesting in my work is that I'm getting to work with a lot of international reporters and telling some stories that I think, smaller U.S.-based newsrooms don't always get to tell. For example, I'm working with a writer in Zimbabwe and India, Malawi, so those different types of places. So that's been an honor to be able to edit and report those stories. And I think also reporting with empathy, remembering that someone sharing their writing with you is a vulnerable thing. It's not easy to, have this person, like, come and slice and dice your work. So I always try to find the positive in it. And I think, too, if your newsroom does have the resources, try to find like editing classes. Again, the Open Notebook has a great science editing series run by Siri Carpenter. I'm trying to think who some other resources. We have a resource guide that we'll share at the end. But yes.
Iris, I wish you were my editor all the time because, it really does require time.
I'm slow to get back drafts, though.
That's great. Like, I need it. I think having an editor like that is really important. It does require a lot of time and community building and source building. I wish editors were more flexible. If your editor isn't flexible, I think you need to find a way to tell the story still, but maybe try to parse it out into a series of stories and be like, okay, I need to do this kind of reporting first, and then this kind of reporting, and then that'll culminate into a larger, you know, feature kind of length story. So, I wish editors were more open and communicative about their own expectations in regards to this beat, but I kind of feel like there's just not enough environmental justice reporters in these newsrooms, and so they don't know how to navigate the beat as much. So, that's all I have.
Great, thank you. So it's time for audience questions. Just a reminder, SCJ and Journalism Group members are prioritized, and I'd love to hear Uproot members, if they're here, ask questions. And do identify yourselves. So we'll go start.
My name is Maria Vasquez, and I'm from the Voces Internship of Idaho program, which is to help encourage more Latinos into journalism. My question is, how do you use your reporting and how do you do it well as a forum to turn it into like advocacy for the effects of climate change on people who work in outdoor labor, like agriculture, construction, etc.? Especially, but not limited to people of color.
Yeah. Who wants to start? Yeah. Anyone who wants to take that first? Go ahead.
Well, that's a great question, and we've done a couple stories on the people of color more likely to be harmed by pesticides, outdoor workers more likely to have heat exhaustion, and the policies that are in place or the lack of to protect outdoor workers. And with that, I've really leaned into people who work with these communities on the ground. I think there's definitely a visual aspect for that as well. If you can get the data from the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, from OSHA, on various with the outdoor workers and heat exhaustion, that one was pretty tricky for me to report because heat exhaustion and heat-related fatalities rarely get classified as such because the symptoms of them, exhaustion, headache, migraine, that can be classified as something that's not related to heat when it is actually heat. So actually going down the lane of proving this can be tricky, but speaking to outdoor workers has been challenging at times, but there is a way. I remember I went on Facebook and I searched unions, and I searched weld workers, masonry unions, and just started messaging people who comment on the posts, people who post, and that's how I was able to find people who actually work outdoors in Nevada and other states. I'm based in New York City, so there is that lack of on-the-ground reporting that I can do. So as much as I can, I would say also Guardian is really good at collaborating with newsrooms locally, so that's been a great help as well because there's a couple stories we collaborated on this matter. And the product is always worth it. The juice is worth the squeeze. Yeah.
I think Aaliyah has the most quotes out of all of us. So, so one story I did was for Prism Reports, and it was on the fruit packing workers who worked at the Allen Brothers Fruit Inc. And they're up in, I think, Yakima, Washington. So the story was on Community to Community Development, which is a nonprofit org, and Familias Unidas por la Justicia, FUJ. And so they were starting this independent farm workers union, but the Allen Brothers was trying to do a lot of union busting tactics to, you know, basically stop them from getting their rights. And this was at the height of COVID, so they had no proper PPE. A lot of issues. So I think that story was one of the first to talk about this independent farmers union. And it was tough because a lot of the farm workers I spoke to were like, we can't use our names because we didn't want to get in trouble. But my main source, Angie, she was like, you know what, I'm going to put my name. So in the end, they ended up getting the union and, you know, being able to do sort of that remote reporting, but still talk to those farm workers, you know, have somebody like help me translate. So that was interesting. And I think using your journalism to be a form of advocacy, I think is one of the honors of being on this beat. So, yeah. And I can send you the link if you want.
Just to repeat the question for recording. So it was about how to work with outdoor workers, agricultural workers, and also kind of journalism as a form of advocacy for those communities. I think there was one right behind. Let me bring the mic, it'll be easier so everyone can hear.
Hello, I'm Manvi Singh. I'm a reporter with Aaliyah at The Guardian. I guess I was curious to hear from all of you because you seem to cover such varied topics from around the world for different, you know, like regionally. I was wondering, you know, what if any kind of efforts you make to kind of stay in touch with people, especially when you cover such a broad area, and if you found any kind of useful ways to do that, to kind of stay engaged with communities after you report on them.
I'm going to just kind of, ring back to what I said before. Volunteer work is really know what happened. I think I just broke the mic, but volunteer work is very involved. I know, like, we're reporters, we do a lot of work already, but I really do think it is very helpful to keep in touch with your sources. Honestly, like, I'm just curious about what my sources are doing all the time, and I'll just, you know, call them up, or some of my sources I have really good relationships with, so I can like text them and be like, you know, if something happens, I could be like, are you okay? How are you affected by this? Really just, you know, on a weekly basis, checking in with your sources and being like, you know, what's going on in your world? You know, things like that, or even, you know, I think it's fine to like invite your source to have coffee sometime or something like that, you know, to really to talk with them. Making your connections and maintaining those connections takes time. And so if you have time to do the volunteer work, I think it's really worthwhile, especially if it's a skill that you really want to learn. Like I very much value being, you know, I very much value local food systems and learning how to grow my own food. And so, you know, I took that to heart and was like, okay, I think I'm going to go volunteer for these farms that I'm also very interested in doing reporting on. And so, I just, you know, it's hard, but like, again, not being parachute-y, you know, not emailing your sources, texting your sources, calling your sources. These are all ways to show that you care about your source.
I think one quick thing I'll add. I think you guys can tell that I have a lot of stories all over the place. One easy thing that I've been able to do is just sign up for all the newsletters that I can related to the organizations that I've covered and people. So anytime I see an event or whoever I know is going to talk about it, I also have Google alerts on some people. I'm like, cool, put that on my calendar. I attend for 20 minutes, email the next day, be like, that was banging. I'm so glad I saw you. And it's an easy way to keep up with people. So sign up for newsletters, subscribe as much as you can. Just having it in your email is like you have them on your mind. And I think Paula had a question next. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, let me bring this.
Hi, I'm Paula Rosa. I'm a freelance science journalist and also a part of the Upper Project. I'm curious, in my experience, perhaps like working with editors that might be have like a dated understanding of like what climate storytelling is, and they might not be responsive to environmental justice stories. Have you ever experienced that? How do you overcome that?
Yeah, I think at The Guardian, what's really has been, exciting is you never really have to prove the, like, you don't have to go, like, I want to do a climate story. They don't ask you, like, it's there's no level of having to prove it because The Guardian is very much a climate-centered publication. However, there's been, as opposed to, like, example would be Wall Street Journal, maybe you have some limitations in justifying something. We don't really have that problem, at least I don't, but there are stories that happen when I report on something, and as you know, you get an assignment, you get a brief, and you want to stick to it, but then in the process of reporting, you uncover something else. And that something else is very pertinent to the story. Again, with the Philadelphia Chinatown example of the highway cap, at the same time, there's a proposal to build this basketball arena right on the edge of Chinatown. And for when I went to Philadelphia, and from the news I was reading and tweets and posts and even flyers, I realized that people are more aware of the arena than the highway cap and than the potential rejoining of Chinatown North and Chinatown South. So when I went there, most people want to talk about that. And my editor didn't assign that to me. So I think, it was a conversation of having, look, you sent me with something else. I found something better. I found something that is way more in people's minds and that I have to report on. So I think with that, it's like, and something I tend to stick to is there are three things I want my story to cover, like three things I will go to bat for. And when I present my story to the editor, I give him five things. So when he takes out something, it's like he wants something, right? He takes out the two, but I really wanted the three to begin with. So it's like a little tactic I do from time to time. You don't always have to do that, but editors want to feel like they made the correct choice, and you just have to lean them into thinking that that's what they wanted in the first place. Yeah.
You guys, I see someone in the back.
Hi, you guys. Thanks for this. I'm Tilly. I'm a freelance reporter in the South Bronx. So thank you very much, Aaliyah, for your reporting there. Iris, I was really interested in your comment from the beginning. I think you said something like, if you have to report on trauma, here's my thought. And I'm wondering when you think it's appropriate to report on trauma and when not, and the sort of pitfalls and how to do that well. And I'd open that up to all of you, but directing it to you first. Thanks.
Thank you for that question. When I think it's important to report on trauma, I think sometimes you kind of have to. Like, for example, I did a story in Oakland, and this was at the height of COVID, and they were doing a lot of sweeps of Oakland for folks that are unhoused. And so I did go out and speak to unhoused people. And yeah, for me, I'm just, you know, it was weird because I'm like, at the end of the day, like, I can go back home to my home and I have a fridge and I have my pets and I have, you know, food to eat. But I'm the one writing this story and I'm going to get paid for it. So it was difficult to really approach the story. And yeah, I went back and I, you know, brought supplies and stuff like that. But, you know, that's only going to do so much. But I think as I started to do a couple more stories on what was happening on the sweeps, I started to understand how I can, you know, balance the reporting. Like, before this person was unhoused, who were they? You know, what makes them John? What makes them Peter? What makes them Iris? So I think just having that ability to balance, like, who they are with, and make sure that their current situation, remembering that their current situation isn't all that they are, I think was helpful. And yesterday there was a wonderful trauma-informed climate journalism panel, which Paula was on, and they mentioned the DART Center out of Columbia, and it's also linked in the resource guide, which we'll share with you all. So I would encourage you looking at that. That has helped me with my reporting a lot as well.
I think we're almost out of time, so I just wanted to see if the panelists have any final thoughts. And Iris, if you can talk more about the guide as well, that'd be great. I'll try to get it up while you guys talk. But yeah, any final thoughts?
Any final thoughts?
You should talk about the guide.
Oh, sure. I can talk about the guide. So we put together a little guide for you guys. Okay. So it has a bit of resources and questions to ask yourself as you... You know what? Hold on. Let me see. I know it's lunchtime, y'all. We're going to get you out of here. So the guide has questions to ask yourself. For example, is there a perspective or community angle missing from my story that I should include? Does my story rely on any assumptions about groups of underrepresented people? It also just gives you tips and tricks about how your reporting can take an intersectional lens, building relationships, reporting with and for frontline communities. And we also put a really great resource from MLK50, Justice Through Journalism. They're a Memphis-based newsroom, and they have tips on how to, it's a rights guide for sources. So this is what it looks like. Yeah. So, we'll put the link in the HOVA app for you guys right after this. And Nathan, can you scroll down? Yeah, so these are the questions. Keep going. Just tips. It's very short. The MLK 50 guide, being trauma-informed. Key definitions. This is from the Solutions Project, and just, like, a couple of things that you guys really need to look at, I think, to approach this beat equitably. So, thank you guys for coming.